Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. A look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control. Control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt, and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks, Walt. Today we'll be hearing from Nomi Prinz. She has a new book out called All the President's Bankers, in which she shows that presidents and bankers have been joined at the hip for at least a century. Before we get to that, I thought I would set the stage with a couple of interesting articles in the news. One is an article from the UK Telegraph called The US is an Oligarchy. It was done by Princeton and Northwestern University, and it concludes, the U.S. government does not represent the interests of the majority of the country's citizens, but is, instead, ruled by those of the rich and powerful. Why are we not surprised? The study looked at nearly 1,800 U.S. policies between 1981 and 2002, and compared them to the expressed preferences of average Americans, affluent Americans, and large special interest groups. The peer-reviewed study says, the central point that emerges from our research is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens, that's us, have little or no independent influence. Researchers concluded that U.S. government policies rarely align with preferences of the majority of Americans. The United States is dominated by the economic elite. So we get some clues into why that is in another recent article, which is even more relevant to Nomi's book. This one's from the UK Guardian, and it's called Wall Street Deregulation Pushed by Clinton Advisors, Documents Reveal. It discusses documents that have newly been released from the Clinton Presidential Library, showing how Clinton was unduly influenced by his advisors, particularly Robert Rubin, who was then Secretary of the Treasury, and Rubin's allies. Rubin walked through the revolving door from Goldman Sachs and walked out again to be on the board of Citigroup and to be chairman of the board briefly in 2007. And what they were leaning on Clinton to do was to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, the act passed in the 1930s, to separate investment banking from depository banking so that banks could not gamble with our deposit. Of course, that act was repealed, or the relevant portion of it that separated depository and investment banking, and we wound up with a huge bubble in the 2000s. Ending in the crash of 2008, and the repeal of Glass-Steagall has been attributed as a major factor in that collapse. So that's the sort of thing that Nomi writes about in her new book, which we'll be hearing about shortly. But first, I wanted to talk about what I've been writing about the last couple weeks. My particular interest is always solutions. How do we get out of the mess that we're in? And since I'm running for California State Treasurer, particularly how do we get out of the mess that California is in? And a lot of that mess is due to interest rate swaps that the state government, city governments, universities, hospitals, and other public entities got into with the largest Wall Street banks, which have now proved to be fraudulent or rigged. 16 of the world's largest banks are now known to have manipulated the LIBOR rate, that's the London Interbank Offering Rate, the rate at which banks borrow from each other. It's also the rate on which interest rate swaps are based, and interest rate swaps globally are a $400 trillion industry, an unbelievable sum. So all that is rigged, and we've seen these lawsuits before, but they were largely involving antitrust, which is like anti-competitive behavior, and RICO, racketeering under the RICO statute. And all those cases were consolidated under a New York judge, and a year ago she ruled that antitrust wasn't appropriate because the 16 banks weren't competing with each other. They didn't intend to compete. They were cooperating with each other. Well, yeah, they were colluding with each other in order to compete unfairly with the rest of the world or with their competitors in the rest of the world. But anyway, that's the status of the litigation to date involving antitrust and RICO. But in March, the FDIC sued in a massive 24-count suit for common law fraud and breach of contract. Those are suits that you can bring in state court, in local court. So what interested me on that was that our state and local governments, our universities, particularly the University of California, which has been a big victim of interest rate swaps, hospitals, etc., could do like the FDIC and sue for fraud and breach of contract. So breach of contract, even just simple breach of contract, allows you to get out of the deal, which is something that these state and local governments haven't been able to do because of the very high termination fees. And for fraud, you can get really substantial damages. You can get punitive damages that are, California courts have been known to give, or juries have been known to give punitive damages that are 30 times actual damages. So you could get some significant remedies from simple breach of contract and fraud against these major banks. So I thought that was pretty interesting and promising. The bottom line is that the cards are stacked against the public and in favor of the big banks. I'm very pleased to be talking to Nomi Prince, who has a new book out, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Nomi is a renowned journalist, author, and speaker. I'll just read a bit from her very extensive bio. She's appeared on numerous TV programs. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times. She's a member of Senator Bernie Sanders' Federal Reserve Reform Advisory Council and is listed as one of America's top wonks. She received her bachelor's in mathematics and her master's in statistics. And before becoming a journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group as a senior managing director at Bear Stearns in London, and worked as a strategist at Lehman Brothers and an analyst at the Chase Manhattan Bank. She's currently a senior fellow at the nonpartisan public policy think tank Demos. Hi, Nomi. Thanks so much for taking the time out from your whirlwind book tour for a chat.
Oh, thank you, Ellen. I'm really happy to be chatting about it with you.
You can chat casually if you like. So your new book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power, is getting rave reviews. Can you just give us like a capsule summary of what the basic theme is and the takeaway?
Well, the basic theme, there's a couple, but the takeaway is that the alliances between the White House and Washington are not something that's just happened recently, but that have snaked back throughout over a century, probably longer, but the century that I cover from the Panic of 1907 and the establishment of the Federal Reserve through today, and the research that I underwent to discover not just what the relationships are, but the nature and the depth and the correspondence and the documentation and the phone calls and all of the meetings and so forth between the key bankers and the last 19 presidents have indicated that there is a very both social and personal and policy impacting relationship between these two poles of power and the leaders of the White House and of Wall Street that has lasted throughout this time through a series of different families, bloodlines, intermarriages, protege mentorship relationships, appointments, and background kind of connections.
Yeah, I flipped right to the back of the book because I'm always interested in the solutions, and your conclusion was, our choice is simple. Either we break the alliances or they will break us. I guess that means the alliance with the presidency or maybe the alliance with the government. But I just wondered, so what's your proposal? What can we do as people?
Well, going to the real solutions, this book, again, it was a ton of history, 500 pages and footnotes of all the information that really binds these two sets of leadership and the power base of America and how that operates nationally and internationally. And so I got to 550 and I didn't have a lot of solutions in the book. But of course, the idea of these alliances and how they impact wars, financing, crises, bailouts after crises are something that we've gotten to a point where the concentration of influence is so powerful, as you know better than anyone, in terms of the sheer amount of capital and leverage and derivatives and bad practices and fraudulent practices and lack of accountability, that what we really need is a completely new system. I mean, we need an overhaul. We don't need just an overhaul in banking. We need an overhaul in the entire alliance system between Washington and Wall Street, because what my book shows is not that it was always poisonous to the people. That's not really what I set out to prove, and nor was it what I found in all the documents. I didn't really have, I didn't know what I would find when I looked at all of the relationships and I kept finding banker after banker having, yachting events and parties and social engagements and barbecues and visits with the White House and all the sorts of things that have happened over time. These alliances used to be very personal. They've become more perfunctionary. And because of that, and because of the bailouts that we've seen since the third world debt crisis, through the Mexican peso crisis, through the latest subprime crisis, they have become deeply dangerous. The alliance and the practices and the policies that it has engendered in our country. And so what I say is, you know, we have to break alliances before the alliances break us. And I mean that from a financial and economic stability standpoint, but also from the standpoint of democracy. If there's so much power, so much capital, so much leveraged capital, so much collusion in the hands of too few people, we don't really have a democracy. There's all sorts of things that need to be done, but really, from the practical aspects of breaking up the biggest banks that have the most power and control the most capital, to going to having them be smaller, to having them be less leveraged, to going through public banking options, community banking options, to separating the speculative activities of these very powerful individuals and players from the deposits and the loans to individuals and small businesses in any way possible is very important. Now, there have been acts that have been passed in Washington recently. The Dodd-Frank Act is one that is supposedly this great reform, but in fact it isn't. And so what we're seeing in Washington is just additional legislation enabling this very unstable environment. And we really need to have better legislation, better regulation, a dissection of risk from deposits and individuals' money, more transparency in the markets, reduced derivatives positions and reduced codependencies of derivatives positions throughout all these financial institutions nationally and globally. I mean, there's many things. But it really comes down to having a system in which the needs of ordinary Americans, the idea of a democracy over our finances, our political decisions, our policies, our economics, is more apparent. It is what we are supposed to be about as a country, but it isn't what we are about. So we need an overhaul of really everything.
I agree that Dodd-Frank is not really going to help. I think it's going to hurt, because it basically says no more bailouts. And so now they're turning to bail-ins, which means the next time there's a breakdown, they'll take the depositors' money. Well, you pointed out that, I forget what the percentage, but the largest percentage of FDIC deposits is from these big six banks. I know there's only $32 billion in the FDIC fund the last time I looked, and there's $1 trillion of deposits in J.P. Morgan and $1 trillion in Bank of America, and that whole fund is supposed to cover something like $6 trillion. You might have better figures than I do. But the point is that we have a really insufficient FDIC fund, and the Dodd-Frank Act says that we, the taxpayers, won't be responsible for bailing out the banks for a big derivatives bust like the Lehman Brothers bust. So what's that mean? They can't borrow from the Treasury next time. So that means they will be taking our deposits. What's your thought on that? And how would you separate out? You had mentioned Glass-Steagall. You had mentioned that in your previous book. I know your previous book better, that you would separate out the depository banking functions and guarantee those. I totally agree with that. I mean, that's the part that should be nationalized or guaranteed by the government. And the other part, let them go. But I wonder if that can actually be done, or, I mean, how it would be done, or how we can move toward getting that done.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it goes back to this utopian idea of what we need to have done and the fact that we have a dysfunctional political financial system, which the people that run Washington and that run the banks have no interest in having this done because they don't have their own money at stake. And this is the problem that we have. And in the past, in history, from the 30s to the 60s, after the Glass-Steagall Act, through World War II, through the Cold War, through LBJ's Great Society program, bankers and presidents were still very connected from a political perspective, a policy perspective, from a money perspective. They hung out with each other. They were friends, but they actually still had a public interest in mind. And they still had this idea that a more stable general economy and a growing economy for the full population was better than a growing economy or, you know, high intense profitability with risk associated for a few. And that began to break down. And I delineate that in the book through, you know, hundreds of pages with footnotes from the 70s on through today. So that's where we're at today. There's no will in Washington to do this. The Dodd-Frank Act doesn't just leave the option of bail-ins in a huge crisis in the sort of unwritten writing of the act. The whole act doesn't work. The Dodd-Frank Act does not split up banks. It doesn't make banks smaller. It doesn't reduce the risk. The idea of having living wills, which has, it has lots of pages with lots more pages of exceptions, all when you read them, and I did read them, all they basically say is that if we have an event like Lehman Brothers with one of these big institutions, they have to try to sell themselves off. They have to try to sell the toxic assets off. They have to try to see if there's an alternative solution. They have to do all the things that were already done. And if those don't work, then the FDIC can come in. But the point is that by the time we get to that situation, we're in a big mega economic crisis. And there is no way, in my opinion, in that situation, that there will not be continued Federal Reserve support like there is today, $4.2 trillion of debt on the books of the Federal Reserve, an epic historic level of securities buying from these large institutions for the most part, sitting on the bank's book, treasury debt created to supposedly help the economy, but it hasn't gone anywhere but to the Fed's book, so it's really just helping these banking institutions that the Fed supports. All of these mechanisms will happen anyway outside of the Dodd-Frank Act. So the fact is, A, it's useless, and B, all the same stuff is going to go on anyway. So we are on the hook, and in addition, we could also have bail-ins. So the situation has not been remedied. It's just been kind of whitewashed by this artificial idea that the Dodd-Frank Act has been reformed or that the Volcker Rule is actually more rule than exceptions, which isn't the case. Almost every form of speculative activity, except a very isolated component, is still allowed under the Volcker Rule because all the lobbyists and lawyers of Wall Street made it so, and nobody in Washington at the senior levels, I mean at the Obama administration, Treasury Secretary, power levels, said anything about it. And so we just really have this dysfunctional situation where all of these supposed remedies, you know, like you said, are not only do they allow for future methods of taking the risk onto depositors and onto the population through bail-ins or through the fact that the FDIC does not have enough money to insure all their deposits and so forth, but it really keeps the same exact too-big-to-fail mentality going, except that now, post the 2008 crisis, the big banks are bigger, they contain more derivatives, they have more of our deposits in one place, they have more assets in one place, and the political financial connections have not been used, certainly from Washington, to hold any of the institutions or their leaders accountable for any of the mess that happened beyond kind of, you know, negligible fines relative to the amount of assets these institutions hold. Less than half of 1% of their assets has been used for fines, of which most of those fines don't even go back to the individuals who are most hurt. They certainly don't go back to the overall economy that suffered. So it's just a bad situation. and we need people to be aware, and there are a few Congress people that are, you know, people like yourself running for positions in public office that know this stuff and that can vocally express what's going on. But, you know, the real issue here is leadership on both sides. And historically, and this is the one hope I have from my book, besides the things we need to happen now as to how they might happen, is that historically there have been decades in the past century where everybody got to keep their power in the White House and Wall Street. There was profit, there was growth, there was expansion, there's all those things that, you know, sort of capitalism provides and is part of the MO of American political and financial strategies. But there was also this idea that stability and broad growth was important. And this is something that has been so lost The one example, and there's so many in the book, but something that I discovered about the Glass-Steagall Act in particular that was passed in 1933 was that when FDR passed that act, it had already been debated for a couple of years, actually, in Congress, starting with Herbert Hoover's administration. So it was a Republican administration that actually launched the PCORA investigation. It was a Democrat administration that continued them and signed the act. But there were bankers. There were actual bankers. Winthrop Aldrich was one who ran Chase at the time, the equivalent of, you know, Jamie Dimon's position now at J.P. Morgan Chase, the legacy bank to that. And he actually worked with FDR to strengthen the regulations of the Glass-Steagall Act. They weren't going to actually cover private banks like the Morgan Bank at first. It was Winthrop Aldrich. First of all, he was competing with the Morgan Bank, but second of all, he really wanted this idea of confidence in the banking system because from a self-interested perspective, it would mean more deposits in his bank, and from a political perspective, it meant he was supporting FDR and FDR was supporting him. But also from a population perspective, it was something that the population needed, demanded, and so all these three kind of groups were aligned. And we have nothing remotely like that today.
I wonder what happened in the 70s. I mean, I've written about it from another perspective, about that was when, I know you wrote that the bankers actually wanted to go off the gold standard, but then when we did go off the gold standard, the dollar collapsed, or, you know, went down, and to save the dollar, according to Bill Engdahl, they met in Sweden in 1973, I think, and I mean some big bankers and Henry Kissinger, and plotted how they would support the dollar with oil by driving the
yep.
price of oil way up. But and then that was also the decade of the Basel Committee, where they sort of changed the rules, where you were supposed to borrow privately, and the governments were supposed to borrow from private banks rather than borrowing from their own central bank, which was considered inflationary. But what something changed then, and it seems like, I mean, before that, like the 30 years or so before that, were quite stable and productive and prosperous in the U.S.
And these political financial elite members were aligned. They knew each other. They worked together. They used each other for their own advantage, but it worked and also the advantage of the country. And they had a lot of negatives in it as well, and I go through those in the book. But yes, there was much more stability, and the alignment worked for a greater stability nationally and internationally. And in the 70s, I don't go through that particular Swedish meeting in the book, it's a fascinating part of the book. In looking at the Nixon files that I did and accessing his relationships and somewhat fights with some of the bankers and what happened afterwards and what happened in through the Carter administration with the Iran hostage crisis, which was very much related to, well, it had been related to the position that bankers had within the Middle East, and particularly David Rockefeller's reaction and actually instigation of what became that crisis. Is something that I go through in the book. But all of that period, two things are happening. One was the alignment, this personal relationships where LBJ, for example, could say to David Rockefeller or George Moore, who was running National City Bank, you know what, I need this from you. So I'm going to do my Great Society. I'm going to do these plans. I need you to be on board. And in return, I will stay out of your, I won't regulate. I'll stay out of your way. You stay out of mine. I'll support you. You support me. And so there was a sort of give or take between the two poles of power. By the time they got to Nixon, he didn't really have that relationship with the bankers. He knew them. They knew him. They tried to get to the White House and influence him, and they did it through the doors of his cabinet rather than him, which is, you know, that's kind of, Watergate was sort of a not subset of that, but sort of this idea that Nixon and his cabinet were doing two different things. But He didn't make them feel warm and fuzzy. He didn't ask them for anything. They pushed the gold standard on him. I have this, you know, I have a lot of documentation about that that's hopefully additive to this argument or this period of history in the book. But basically, then they went off and found oil. So having pushed, as you mentioned, the gold standard to disintegrate, and Nixon was the one who made the speech about it, but it was really at the bequest of bankers like Walter Wriston, who ran National City Bank, came City Bank, now Citigroup, that really pressed this idea of both free markets, open trade, and no assets behind currency. And that was something that very much was pushed by the bankers. It had actually been pushed under Kennedy, but it happened under Nixon. And in addition, as they found more money in oil and more ability to influence what was going on with oil and had more relationships in the Middle East, on a political and a financial basis, bankers on a political financial basis, they were able to recycle that petrodollar money, those profits, through their branches in London into the U.S., converted it to debt, which was dumped on Latin America, and did this whole sort of global churning, while the countries were suffering from high oil prices. They were making a boatload of money. And so this idea of this alliance that I talk about in my book between leaders of politics and leaders of finance really disintegrated from the standpoint of being helpful to mm-hmm. populations as well as to bankers, and became a sole self-interested sort of thing, because bankers realized, you know what, we can go and do our own thing. And the government still supported them doing that thing, but they didn't have any demand for accountability on the other side, and therefore they also didn't provide it. And then sort of that continued. We had the third world debt crisis because of that disalignment and the oil and the gold standard being dropped. And then the response of the administrations, the Reagan and the Bush administration, was to push to bail out the private banks from their debts or the debt that they had lavished on Latin America, and to support IMF and World Bank initiatives that sort of backed helping these countries and basically giving them money so that they could pay back the banks, so that the banks would be whole, so all these other backdoor bailouts. And all of that started to further disintegrate any sort of positive alliance and just, you know, have a more devastating consequence type of alliance. And then that just continued into them pushing, because that was all working deregulation and more methods of using, you know, whether it's depositors' capital or bailout money or devalued currency without assets behind it or whatever it was, to continue to push the envelope of reducing regulation, which they did through the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the other Bush administration. And, you know, we saw the results come to fruition in several crises during that period, as well as in the most recent one in 2008.
I wonder if I could shift to something else. In your last book, It Takes a Pillage, you had mentioned that mortgage-backed securities were 90% fluff, and that we had like $1.4 trillion in subprime loans, which became $14 trillion in securities, which became the collateral for $140 trillion in debt.
Right.
The reason I ask is that I'm pursuing a theory that I haven't quite nailed it down yet, so I haven't actually written about it. But it seems to me that the reason that we had all the robo-signing was that those mortgage-backed securities were being used as pawns in the
yeah.
repo market, and therefore they didn't want to sign them until they had to. I mean, they wanted to leave them as negotiable instruments, bearer debt or whatever, you know, things you could sell and buy
yeah.
back in the repo
yeah.
market. So could you explain that about the fluff? And
do you agree that
was what they were using them for?
Well, I mean, that was just one of many things. I mean, if you have loans, you know, whether it's RoboCop time loans being used as repo, being used as collateral for money that could be used for other speculative activities or to support the speculativities you already had on your books, then that's one way of converting a loan into kind of a betting chip. And that was one way of doing that. And other ways were just the sheer way in which loans were packaged together and these toxic assets that is the label for them. But these various types of transactions that contain very little real, they didn't have to contain real loans because whatever loans were in there, whether they were loans that were paying, whether the loans that weren't paying, whether they were loans that had fraud behind them or didn't, they were all sort of packaged up and rounded up, and they were sold and resold and resold many, many times in each time to create these new securities, which could then be traded and sold more and profited from. So it was really like an upside-down pyramid where at the little tiny bottom point, you know, you imagine an upside-down triangle, the bottom tiny little point is the actual loan, and by the time you go up through all sorts of mechanisms of using that same loan for various purposes, you know, you get this very, very unstable upside down triangle, which is what we had. And you know, when I say there was 140 trillion that was created, I mean it's really just an estimate. We don't really know, because there's no way in current global finance to And in the way in which these banks could restructure and manufacture and move these loans into securities and move these securities into other places and sell them and buy them back and forth to create profit or as collateral for more money to do other things with, there's no real way to trace the number of times one single loan was used in this entire pyramid. No one knows that. There's no report at the Fed, there's no report at the Treasury Department, there's nowhere in banking that you can literally say, oh, you know, loan from, you know, Mr. Smith in Iowa and so whatever, it has been used 120 times and here's all the securities that relate to. There's no way to know that.
It looks like blatant fraud, and it seems to me that, well, because every time,
first of all, if the loan is fraudulent to begin with, we still can't trace it, but it's obvious. But if the loan is part of a package of loans that somewhat are good and somewhat are fraudulent, then it really serves the same potentially shady purpose in propping up another security that contains that loan that by the fact it contains some fraud and maybe some good loans is fraudulent. So, I mean, it just perpetuates, because these loans can be used and reused, it just perpetuates this whole big array of leveraged assets that have no real reporting mechanism or restraint mechanism to even analyze them throughout all the different banks that trade them back and forth and create them and move them around.
Speaking of fraud, I was just writing about the FDIC suit for the LIBOR rigging against 16 of
them. Yeah, I saw your piece.
Yeah, world's largest banks. I mean, how is it that we continue to do business with proven fraudsters? Eric Holder says that they're too big to prosecute, but why? Why can't we prosecute? What would happen
if there's no will. I mean, this goes back to this idea of these political financial alliances. I mean, you have decades of the most powerful individuals in finance and in politics. And I don't mean all of them. I mean the most powerful ones that are so interconnected and so aligned from the standpoint of policy or social status or education or so many different points of connectivity that when you get to the level of will we prosecute someone like Jamie Dimon, well, no, we won't, because he's sitting on top, first of all, of a legacy institution that has tremendous connections with Washington that have built up through a century, which I go back through in All the President's Bankers, and also a lot of personal connections and financial political relationships that we don't even see. And so, no, there's not going to be the will at that level of power to question itself. And that's part of the reason I think we have had the Department of Justice, which is a part of the executive branch, really drop and act as if they don't have enough information or whatever to prosecute. They just create a fine, have an agreement, and everyone goes back to what they were doing.
But the implication, it seemed to me, was that if you prosecute them, it is a pyramid scheme, and it's like you're taking out the little pegs at the bottom, and the whole scheme will collapse. But obviously, that's a bad way to run a money system. People have told me, like, I always have schemes about having, I mean, if you could prove, for example, that all these mortgage-backed securities are fraudulent, then the people opposed to that would say, well, there's no way that the courts would rule that way because that would destroy the banking system, and they won't do that. But it seems to me we should do that, and then, to, like you say, nationalize the depository part and let the other part sink or swim on its own. What would happen if you just netted out all the derivatives? I know Paul Craig Roberts proposed that, I think.
Well, I think netting out the derivatives and reducing all those interdependencies and all the risk associated with them, you would see that a lot of them are, most of them are fully unnecessary and they're just there to create profit and, you know, a stream that we can't regulate or control. And we, again, subsidize this risk through Federal Reserve policies, through not using the money in other ways, through having an FDIC that can support some depositors, but not really if the whole system collapses. And we act as if, as long as it doesn't collapse, everything's okay. Because when it gets to the point of possible brink of collapse, there's so much support that comes from Washington, from different avenues, to make sure it doesn't collapse. But again, this is a very historic, which is why I went back to really the beginning of financial capitalism in the early 1900s, when money started being used for leverage rather than embedding, rather than, you know, more for productive ventures that were also speculative, but there was like an associated production of something in them. And all the alliances, all the personal alliances and political financial activities that have occurred integrate for a reason. There is a belief at the top echelons of politics, and there have been for over the past century, and the top echelons of banking, that the manner in which our system has existed and continues to be formulated is important to America as a whole. You know, the fact that we have these crises are written off, or we'll have some laws that aren't really effective but are propped up from the standpoint of speeches and rhetoric as being effective, like Dodd-Frank, and things continue as they are, because at the base level of these alliances, these long-standing personal connections and similar ideologies and backgrounds, there is the notion that this is how it is supposed to be.
Well, I just wonder, though, how long they can keep it propped up. I saw a good video of a documentary on Russia, and in the 1990s, the oligarchs were in power. But at some point, when they did start taking the depositors' money, basically, that's when the people turned on them. And
well,
then,
they didn't have a Federal Reserve like ours was carrying $4.2 trillion of basically debt on their books. So yes, agree, that can definitely happen. But I think that's one of the reasons that there's been so much propping up of the system to specifically avoid that, which you know, Russia wasn't able to do. We have the most supportive, you know, quasi-central bank and Treasury Department, and it's been established that way from the get-go, of the most concentrated and powerful banking institutions that have our deposits of any other country. And so, yes, it should implode. It's not logical, but it's these policies and connections, which I talk about in All the President's Bankers, that are continuing.
Thank you for all that. If you have another minute, I'm just sort of curious about your whole history. Well, it's interesting to me that you got your master's in statistics and you finished everything you needed for the PhD except the paper. My son did exactly the same thing, and that's what he's in, econometrics. And he got to the end of the line and he said, no, this was a waste of time. Anyway, so I just wondered about your career. How did you get into Wall Street banking?
Yeah, when I got into Wall Street banking, I didn't have a checking account. I didn't know where Wall Street was. I had absolutely no idea or intention, but I did have a degree in mathematics and in programming. And at the time, that's all the jobs were on Wall Street. And I wanted to live in New York City like anyone. I was 19. Anyone who graduated college and I went to a state university of New York at Purchase. I wanted to live in New York, so it was a job. And then yes, I wound up staying in a very long time and moving through it. I did my PhD work while I was working at Lehman Brothers, so I was just literally working all the time. I mean, I'll go in and do foreign exchange stuff at 5:30 in the morning. I'd occasionally get out for a seminar that I had to take. I was doing all my courses. I mean, it was exhausting. And when I got to the standpoint of the paper, I actually got an offer to move to London to start this analytics department at Bear Stearns, and I said I always wanted to move to London after I moved to New York, and so I made that choice, much more for a geographical reason, I think, than a banking reason.
Uh-huh. And then you dropped out eventually, so I guess you're turned off the whole thing? Or?
Well, I think you had 3 years to finish it. I was enjoying living overseas in Europe and London, and life just took its own course, I think, at that point.
Mm-hmm. And then I want to ask what you think of public banking and whether that is a potential solution, since that's my thing.
Yeah, no, I think, as you mentioned, the component of public banking, like of separating deposits, having them, and basic lending and basic deposit-taking services, like banks kind of were supposed to be doing and not using those funds for speculative purposes, you know, you've shown that, you know, where that works. In North Dakota, it works, and it's stable. And I think if we could adopt that as a national agenda, we would have more stability for the money that's important to us that we use, and it wouldn't be used for speculative purposes. I think you would need a combination of a Glass-Steagall Act, a real one, not like a Dodd-Frank BS one, but like a real Glass-Steagall Act, to be in conjunction with public banking as well, to make that whole effort even more secure for individuals. Because what we're really saying, like what you're, you know, public banking and the initiatives, you know, the money of real people is really important to their lives. And to have institutions use it for such immense speculation that should not be its purpose, and plus can create these crises and panics whereby they get saved by the federal government and individuals don't, and there's such an incentive to use people's deposits and loans in that manner, that that's inherently bad for everyone except the people that are profiting most acutely at any particular given moment from using other people's money for those activities. So what happened to save the banking system? The reason that zero interest rate has been the policy of the Fed for so long, for more historically long than any other period in time, in our history since the Fed has been around, is because it benefits the banks, not because it benefits individuals or the stability of their own assets, you know, their financial assets in banks. So I think if we could have that disassociation, separation, deposits and regular banking activities from banks that speculate with our money and our loans in that way, it would be better for people and better for not just our country, but, I mean, globally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And then I just have one more question. What happened to antitrust? I mean, I know you've written about Teddy Roosevelt and that. Why is it that the banks are not, why are they exempt from antitrust? Or
well, this is one of the most fascinating sort of through lines of the personal alliances in my book, is that back in the panic of 1907, while Teddy Roosevelt was talking about trust busting and busting other types of trust or other types of conglomerate companies that were monopolizing certain elements of the economy, he did not bust banks. He never busted banks. The reason he didn't bust banks was that he was friends with J.P. Morgan, and B, in the panic in 1907, he was afraid of, at the time he hadn't not yet announced that he wasn't running for re-election, that Taft was going to run in the next term, but, you know, he wanted to preserve the economy. He wanted to preserve his power as the president. He really truly believed that J.P. Morgan could get this done, and he gave J.P. Morgan the power of fixing the markets at the time in the wake of the 1907 panic. And that was something that really stuck. And Woodrow Wilson, a couple presidencies later, did the same thing when we went to war, World War One. The Morgan Bank, which is the legacy of J.P. Morgan, he died in 1913, and then his son took over. Jack Morgan, they also had that position where the Sherman Antitrust Act had been established before that. The Clayton Antitrust Act, which was supposed to strengthen it, was being debated in Congress as the world was marching to war, as the U.S. was going to be a part of it. And Jack Morgan said, and I it's some fascinating like correspondence in my book where I uncovered these letters, but he effectively said to Woodrow Wilson, look, you know, we certainly don't want to have a financial panic at home because we need to be strong so that we could finance this war. And by the way, we will help to do that. And what we need from you is to kind of water down the Clayton Antitrust Act. So it was another element where Woodrow Wilson was like, well, okay, I'm going to war. The Morgan Bank wound up financing 75% of all the financing of the war, including helping the Treasury Department to finance part of the war. And that was something that Woodrow Wilson needed more. And as a kind of bargaining chip, he took banks out of the antitrust conversation. So there's been all these periods throughout time, but it really started, and that's one of the reasons I went back so far, it really started with the Morgan Bank and Teddy Roosevelt for Woodrow Wilson of this idea that banking monopolies, even though they all consider them dangerous and they all spoke publicly of their danger, were not something to be messed with. And as a result, today we have such a high concentration. You know, it is not by accident of these largest banks, of which J.P. Morgan Chase is a legacy bank of the Morgan Bank. It's not an accident. This was something that was put in play by real people and real decisions and real relationships and real conversations that date back 100 years.
So, but there's no exemption. I mean, there's no actual legislation that says that we can't break up the banks.
There's a lot of language, but no, there's so much kind of muddy language, and I don't have the whole act in front of me right now. I have to admit, but the language is such that certain financial services are exempt from because you know, at the time they were over state lines, or they weren't state lines, or they solidified in certain aspects and certain others. But all the sort of watering down of the antitrust acts at the time, and just the fact that there was no trust busting whatsoever at all before that, just manifested in additional loopholes like that being written into other laws that were created over time since. And so there's a lot of intricate language exempting without saying we are exempting a lot of these financial services companies for different reasons over time. I mean, now they're all, because of the Glass-Steagall Appeal in 1999, all the interstate banking, all of insurance, mutual funds, asset management, commercial banking, it's all under one roof. But as it was consolidating under one roof and these things were being discussed, there was always a loophole into that consolidation that allowed the big banks, you know, I'm saying the banks that are now the big six banks, that allowed them to not be a part of whatever antitrust laws were being put out. There was a lot of, there was a Department of Justice investigations into antitrust that happened, for example, in the 60s under LBJ, and he just let it slide for banks. He kind of like talked behind the scenes. There's some interesting information in my book and All the President's Bankers about that. So it honestly was a bunch of language and also alliances between presidents and bankers that enabled the big banks that have our deposits and speculate them and have our backing to be in the position that they are.
But I would think, like with these proven frauds, like J.P. Morgan has been caught in a dozen frauds, and the 16 banks that were caught in the. But it's not just just that one manipulation. There are all these things that they've done. You would could somebody sue under the antitrust or under Sherman Act, or do they have to change their legislation?
I think they would have to change a lot of legislation because, again, it's all been augmented over time to kind of allow any new manifestation of these banks to protect them a lot. So you'd have to basically, it's almost like you'd have to unwrap that whole, you know, you can sue for fraud, you can sue for civil fraud, for things like that. But
that's what we should,
and I know you've been, you know, that should definitely happen, but from the elite standpoint, from the power perspective in Washington, there's no will to do this because they've really been a part of creating it. Like, they've been on the same team. They are the same team. You know, and the result is where we are today. So, yeah, I mean, there were frauds along the way. I mean, there's, you know, I talk about the 70s, how there was a big, in the book, David Rockefeller and his boss were having dinner somewhere in Washington at an IMF or World Bank. I don't remember dinner. It's in the book. But, and there was this notification that one of their treasury bond traders had been, you know, scamming prices, and this was going to become a big deal. So they come back to New York. They have this like big meeting at one of the Rockefeller homes, and they talk about how they're going to spin it, what they're going to do, and it wound up going away. There was a tiny little fine that I think they paid a couple of years later, but then they, you know, they fire the traitor, which is something that keeps happening. They fire the one guy or the one woman or whatever along the way, and that was it. You know, the bank was fine. So, you know, there's been so many instances of that where, or yes, there's been a big fraud and it's been noticed and it's either linked back to the chairman of a bank or, you know, a major trading department of the bank, and it just sort of gets whitewashed. You know, there might be a fine, there might be a admission of guilt or not, usually not, and someone gets fired. And that's really what tends to happen. And again, and particularly with the most powerful institutions. I mean, yeah, Bernie Madoff, for example, went to jail. He didn't work as a chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, so they're really, and this is what I really focused on in All the President's Bankers, the unaccountability aspect, the power consolidation aspect between Washington and Wall Street is most potent at these institutions that have lived and prospered and consolidated over this past 100 years. There's been a couple of newbies like Wells Fargo and, you know, to a limited extent Bank of America, but they've sort of been involved throughout the years, just more mid-century. But, you know, the J.P. Morgan Bank, it's a and Citigroup are constellations of the big six banks near the turn of the century. So there's been reasons for this. It hasn't been an accident that the institutions we have today have those through lines to those relationships between real people back over 100 years ago and since.
Well, that's a marathon amount of work you've done, and your fund of knowledge, you're really amazing.
It was a lot of it was very interesting. I sat with a lot of documents for a couple of years in a lot of presidential libraries, and so you know, what we're talking about today is kind of all a result of, in a lot of cases, new knowledge just found from digging around.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Do you want to give your, where people can find you, find your books, what's going on, where they might see you somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I keep everything as much updated as possible on my website, which is www.nomiprins.com. So there's information about the book, about events, about media stuff in different tabs there. And then to get the book, probably, you know, either in a local store or better price actually is on Amazon.com, and just look for All the President's Bankers or my name.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ellen.
Today on the Public Banking Report, we're going to have a conversation with Gwen Hallsmith, the new Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute.
Gwen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Walt.
You're the new executive director, and you've been active in the field for many years. And there's a new direction at PBI in terms of the scope of the activities and the focuses. Would you tell us a little bit about what's new with the Public Banking Institute?
What's new is the New Economy Academy. We started an educational program to fulfill our mission of supporting all the different efforts that are on the ground trying to make public banks happen. And we had our first two classes this last weekend, which was really exciting. One of the classes is Introduction to Public Banking, and the other one was called Establishing a Public Bank, sort of like Public Banking 101 and 102. I taught it with Tom Seguros from Rhode Island, who's just published a book called Checking the Banks, the Nuts and Bolts of Banking for people who want to fix it. We had a lot of people signing up for the class, which was great, lots of good discussion, and I'd call it a success.
You're planning on doing some more courses as well?
We're actually offering another one on community economic resilience, a longer course that will allow people to understand how public banking fits into an overall economic strategy for their area. Public banking, of course, is a tool, and it's a technique. It's not an end in itself. And the end in itself, of course, are healthy and vibrant and economically satisfying communities. But even public banking is half of the equation in terms of how to foster economic development, because public banking helps you identify a source of funds for more economic development investing and more public infrastructure investing, but it doesn't actually tell you a lot about how to make those investments and how to make those loans and how to encourage the right kind of economic activity to make sure that your community or your state is going to be thriving in the future. So this new course, which is a little longer, will show how communities can work together to create a thriving economy and how public banking fits into that picture.
Will there be several additional courses or a way to subscribe to this?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to offer courses in things like how to read your combined annual financial report. That sounds wonky as well, but it's a really important skill for people advocating public banking, how to do an economic analysis of the impact of a public bank on your area, as well as a number of other courses that people are proposing. The idea is to offer the courses live to begin with, and then to record them so that they're available for people who can take them at their convenience. The live classes will typically be a little more expensive than the recorded classes, but the Public Banking Institute can be available for email conversations with people who have taken the class, in addition to the in-person possibilities that are there when you take the live class.
Now, for the last 2 years, Public Banking Institute has had national conferences. Are there any gatherings that are planned for this coming year?
Yeah, we have three activities planned so far, and one that's being considered and hasn't been scheduled yet. One is the Great Debate in Detroit, which is scheduled for June 2nd. We're going to be offering and supporting a debate by the Urban Debate League of Detroit at the Detroit Academy for Arts in the evening of June 2nd. And during the day, we're going to be meeting with people who are really excited about starting a public banking initiative in Michigan and going through the process of how they can form a coalition and get the process moving forward. That session would also be interesting for other people from outside of Michigan, and people from all over are invited to come. We're also helping with two other events, one in New Mexico on September 27th that is organized by the Movement for Public Banking in New Mexico, and another one in Seattle, which is still tentative at this point, but they're looking at having a symposium on public banking in October. So we're working to support all of those initiatives and talking about a national conference in Detroit, which also would be in October.
The debate idea is a really interesting variation and one, I suppose, that could be created in a lot of cities. So if people were interested in having their students, whether high school or college students, they could recreate that conversation of getting down to the nuts and bolts of what public banking is and how it stands up against the opposition. Is that something the Public Banking Institute would be interested in fostering?
Absolutely. There's nothing quite as effective as having students involved in an issue to get the parents interested in it, too.
The idea of local economic resilience is kind of a new topic on the academia of economic study, in that it's not so tied to the traditional philosophical schools of thought and kind of branches into a more practical aspect of, you know, how does the economy work on the street, you know, in our communities. Any thought about taking that into academia in a more formal sort of a way where economics departments might adopt or include that?
Absolutely. I think it's really important for economics departments to start taking economic resilience and the new economics that we're developing as part of this whole national movement a lot more seriously. I think there's a lot of evidence that traditional economics, which is the neoclassical or neoliberal school, has failed us miserably. They assume a lot of things that just aren't true. Their economic models are what are driving us into economic devastation, really. So we need to think more and better about how the economy works, and that's been an effort that I've been leading here in Vermont, and I'd like to see more conversations about it around the country. Public banking is an important part of that, because one of the interesting features of our current school of economic thought is that they take the privatized monetary system for granted. Monetary systems are not really a subject of a lot of economic classes, and if you look at how they study money, they tell you, well, money is a store of value, it's a unit of account, it's a means of exchange. They don't actually talk at all about the impacts of the privatized monetary system on the economy. Even the Nobel Peace Prize in economics is not actually a Nobel Prize. It's a prize that was invented by the central banks. In fact, a couple years ago, the Nobel Committee distanced itself from that prize, making it really clear that it wasn't part of their panoply of normal prizes. Prize that was invented by the central banks, and I dare say you will never find an economics prize in that category for anybody that questioned the role of the privatized monetary system. If we're really looking at creating resilient communities, we need to understand how the economy works, how money and banking play a role in it, and what we can do to change it.
And so the people who are attending these conferences are really kind of the front line of representing a different philosophical approach to local economies, distinct from the managing politicians or the managing bureaucracy of the funds that a community has.
And offering it to people who are from all walks of life. You don't have to be a PhD student to take our classes. And we're making them accessible to people who aren't necessarily PhDs in economics and trying to make economics itself more accessible to the general public. Because honestly, until people really understand the impacts of this economy and the dangers and pitfalls of it, we're not going to be able to change it.
How would people find out about the Public Banking Academy and the various course offerings?
Well, right on our website, www.publicbankinginstitute.org. You go to learn more, and that brings you to the place where you can sign up for membership and sign up for classes. We're trying to encourage people to become members of the Public Banking Institute by offering the classes at reduced or no cost, depending on your membership status. So please join the Public Banking Institute, join our learning community, and start to learn more about how we can transform the economy through the techniques that we're talking about in public banking and through other means.
That's great, Gwen. Thank you very much for the time today, and we'll look forward to talking to you again soon on this and related subjects.
Great. Thanks
Take
so much,
care.
Paul. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
That's Gwen Hall-Smith, Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute.
Money, the getaway.
So that does it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Thank you very much for joining us, and our thanks this week to Nomi Prinz and to Gwen Hall-Smith. Nomi Prinz's book is All the President's Bankers. Ellen's books and articles are available at ellenbrown.com. Also, thanks to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia. If you'd like to get a podcast of this show, go to prn.fm and go to the It's Our Money with Ellen Brown show. On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. Thanks for listening.